You've always been looking for something. That something that sets you apart. That something that makes you more than the person you're living as. More into the person you were created to be. What others see as mundane, you see as magnificent. You catch a glimpse of something new, and it becomes something significant. It's that something extra that keeps you up at night. The hours pass by while everyone else sleeps. You dream. You imagine. You envision what your life might be. What if you were born for more? There's got to be more than just this. I want to be used. That's your greatest wish. The demand for you has always been true. You are gifted and passionate. Add God's purpose to this and watch what He can build. Now, what will you do with what you've been given? Will you put it into motion? Will you take on the responsibility? Will you follow after the calling God has placed on your life? To be fulfilled, to be engaged, to cast out all fears, doubts, and uncertainties, to stand strong, to rise up, to become who you were created to be. Who is the prodigy in you?
Well, good morning, and welcome. As John said, welcome to Hoboken Grace. This morning, we've got all sorts of really exciting and new things happening throughout our spaces and our services as we walk into the fall. And I don't know if you guys noticed as you walked in, our program changed a little bit, and you guys here at the 12 o'clock service are used to this, but now our online program has been rolled out across all of our locations. Today, there's all sorts of cool things starting today. NFL kicks off today. How many of you are excited? NFL in full? Yeah, there's like four of you here who are. I was excited until Thursday night. My fantasy quarterback had an awful night, and then Michigan lost to Notre Dame yesterday, and I'm just going to act like football doesn't exist moving forward. But there's all sorts of really exciting things. I love the fall. For some reason, summers for me just get too busy. There's too many things going on. I just love the fall. I love looking forward to it, and the temperature goes down a little bit. The weather's perfect. I just love everything about it, and I love the fall as it pertains to our church family as well, because it's a chance for everybody to begin to come back together, and oftentimes as we move through the year, it's kind of a focal point for us as far as where we're moving throughout the year. And that's exactly what's true about today as well, because throughout this year, everything that we've been talking about has kind of been leading up to and building up to this conversation. What if? What if you were born for more? And we've been looking at this unbelievable story that God has brought us into and how we're gifted in that and how the church fits in that. All of this leading up to this conversation. What if, in the midst of this incredible story, what if you were born for more? In the midst of this beautiful story, we've been looking at it throughout the entire year, this beautiful story, the beauty of how God loves and the beauty of what God's doing. And before we go any further today, I just want to take a second to be able to acknowledge the fact that as we've been talking about this, the beauty of God's story, the beauty of what God's doing, I'm aware of the fact that there's tension in that. I'm aware of the fact that there's a little bit of conflict in that. And maybe some of you have felt that as we've walked through this year, and you keep hearing me say this beautiful story, this beautiful story. But even as I've said it, I've understood and I've known and I've been acutely aware of the fact that for some of us, it's really difficult to hear that. And for some of us, we don't necessarily even know if that's true, because when we look at the story around us, we're not really sure that it matches this idea of a beautiful story. Because I think for many of us, as we look at the world around us and the story that we find ourselves in the midst of, rather than seeing a beautiful story, I'm afraid that oftentimes we're confronted with the reality that the story is just unbelievably broken. And so you look at the headlines, or you look at what's trending, or you're constantly being confronted with this reality that, if we're honest with ourselves, doesn't necessarily look like a beautiful story. And I'm aware of the fact that as we've walked through this year, for some of you, if not many of you, there's been this ongoing tension. You hear us talking about this beautiful story that God's brought us into, this amazing story that he's telling, but then you look, even at today's headlines, you look at what's happened recently, and you look at the story of Ferguson, or you look at what's happening in the Middle East. Recently, Anna and I have just been struck by these stories of children in the Middle East who are literally being slaughtered because of the fact that they call themselves followers of Christ. You look at those stories, and then you hear us talking about this beautiful story, this amazing story that God has created you to be part of. And I think for many of us, and I think probably for all of us at some point or another, there's this tension. That, man, I'd like to believe that it's a beautiful story, but I'm not actually sure that it is. I'm not actually sure that it is. And sometimes it's a global story, but oftentimes it's also a very personal story, and something that you've walked through this year, or something that you're walking through at this moment, this difficulty, this pain, this struggle, and you're looking at it, and for you, it's anything but a beautiful story. And as we're confronted with this, oftentimes it can begin to really impact and influence the way that we look at and see God. As a matter of fact, as I have the opportunity to be able to have conversations with those who are journeying with us who don't believe in God, and one of the really cool things about my position is that as a pastor, I often get to have conversations with atheists, and for some reason, whenever an atheist attends our church, they always feel the need to come and introduce themselves to me, and so immediately they'll come, "Hi, my name's Bob, and I don't believe in God, and I just want to let you know that, just so you don't waste your time on me." And I'm like, "Well, I didn't know you were here before, but now I do, and so I'm so excited to have a conversation with you." And I get to be able to sit down and have these conversations, and I love it because it forces me to really interact with some of those difficult conversations of who God is and how God works. And as I have the chance to do that, one of the things that I've found is that for those of us who don't yet believe in God, the struggle is very rarely this idea that there would be an all-powerful being, or that there would actually be someone or something that's more powerful than we are. I don't think there's very many of us who struggle with that. But what I find in those conversations is that at the heart of this conflict is not necessarily that there could be an all-powerful God, but that when we look at the story. And I hear this over and over again. I look at the story and I look at what's happening in the world, and I can't possibly believe that there would be a good God who could be part of this. And so therefore, I don't believe in God. It's interesting to me because it's very similar to a conversation that you might have with someone who was abandoned by their father at a very early age, or abandoned by the father in a tragic way. And maybe you've had this conversation before, or you've experienced this before, but you have a conversation with them, and in the course of the conversation, somehow their dad comes up and you ask them about their dad, or someone references their dad, and immediately their response is, "I don't have a dad." All of us have a dad. But sometimes it's easier to say I don't have a dad than it is to say my dad didn't care enough to show up. And what I've found in this conversation about who God is and whether God exists is this unbelievable tension. And I think for some of us, we'd rather just say that there is no God than to say, no, there is a God, and yet it looks like he just didn't care enough to show up. Because as we're confronted with this story that is supposedly this incredible story, we look at it and we're like, no, it's not supposed to be like this. Like, how could there possibly be a God if the story looks like this? For some of you, maybe that's you today. You've explored this idea of God, but the overwhelming brokenness of the story just has brought you to the point where you've either given up on the idea, or maybe you've just decided it's not worth your time to actually take the time to find out who he is, because it doesn't seem like he took the time to do anything about the story. Maybe some of you are here today in that position. And you came because a really good-looking girl invited you to come. And you don't really believe in God, but you're like, I'll come listen to some idiot talk about God. I don't care as long as I get to be near her. And so you decided to come in, but you've just been overwhelmed by this story. I think if we're honest, all of us have been there. I think if we're honest, probably many of us are there right now. And we look at what's happening around us. We're brought to this place over and over again, and it's not supposed to be like this. And we're overwhelmed by it. And we think to ourselves, God, how could this be the beautiful story? How could this be an amazing story? I remember a couple of years ago, I had the opportunity to be able to volunteer at the Jubilee Center, which is on the backside of Hoboken here. It's an after-school program. And the church was young, and so there was only like one service at the time. There wasn't all that much to do, so I decided I'd go and volunteer and help these kids out. And I went once a week after school, and just there were five of them that were assigned to me, and I'd just spend a couple hours with them every Thursday afternoon, just walking through their homework, and really more than anything, just spending time with them, getting to know them, and being the person who cared enough to show up. And I'll never forget one day in particular, because as we're walking through homework, they were talking over top of that and doing a little bit of homework and a lot of bit of talking. And as they're talking back and forth, I remember the kid who was sitting next to me spoke up, and he was talking to the kid who was sitting across from him. And he said something just very nonchalantly, just kind of mentioning it. He's like, oh, yeah, you know, I saw your dad the other day. And I'll never forget, I can remember it like it was yesterday. I can remember him standing up, because he kind of stood up out of his chair on the table, and his head popped up, and immediately he's like, you saw my dad? Where did you see my dad? When did you see my dad? And he starts going through all these different questions. And I was like, man, what in the world just happened? As the conversation went on, I found out that this little 7-year-old boy hadn't seen his dad in 3 months. And before that, it was a significantly long stretch. It's basically just these occasional moments in his life when he would get to see his dad. Not that he would be able to actually be held by his dad, but that he even just got the chance to be able to see him. And as I watched this conversation play out, I was just overwhelmed by this, I mean, just this kid. He just, all he wanted, he just longed just to be able to see his dad. And he's so loving and forgiving. Because as he's talking to these kids, he's like, man, you should meet my dad. My dad's so cool. And I just kept thinking in my head, no, he's not. What? Just longing. But I remember I walked out of there that afternoon. And it was just one of those moments. I think all of us have encountered one of those moments when you look at the story, you just think to yourself, I was walking back to my office and I just kept thinking over and over again, it's not supposed to be like this. It's not supposed to be like this for that kid. I think all of us encounter these moments. And for many of us, it's in those moments that we begin to drift away from God, or that we begin to give up on the existence of God. Because we look at these two things, that God is in some way telling this story, and we look at what is and we say, I don't understand how the two work together. And so we begin to walk away. And as we begin this conversation today, what I want to do is I want to take us to a story where we find someone in the midst of one of these situations. Because I think as you look at the story of Nehemiah, you find someone who is in a moment where he's looking at the story and he's saying, listen, it's not supposed to be this way. But I think as you watch him interact with it, we learn a lot about how to be able to look at the two and see, okay, how do these work together? And what is this supposed to look like? And so what I want to do today is I want to take us back to this story to be able to see how he engaged that moment, to see if just maybe it might inform how we begin to engage those moments. I want to take you back to Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 1. And for the next couple of weeks, we're going to be walking through the beginning of this book of Nehemiah. If you get a chance to be able to read it, I encourage you to read it and just kind of hear the whole story. It won't take you that long. It's not an incredibly long book, but just sit down one day. Even if you can read through the first 7 chapters, you get an idea of what we're going to be talking through over the next few weeks as we dive into this unbelievable story of how God uses Nehemiah. But we're going to start off in chapter 1. And I know for some of you are sitting here thinking, I'm not going to read that. And sometimes I'll have conversations with people that, well, I don't really read the Bible. I don't believe it's true. Let me just throw something out there really quickly. You don't read any book because you believe it's true. Like, there's no book that you pick up. You're like, you're in the library. You're like, oh, you know what? I bet that book's entirely true. I will pick that up and read it. No. Even in school, you didn't read books that way. And so, but for some reason, it's like a disclaimer that, oh, I'm not going to read it. I don't care if you believe it. Just read it. Just hear what God's saying and begin to enter into this conversation. So Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 1 starts off. It says, these are the memoirs of Nehemiah. In late autumn, in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes' reign, I was at the fortress of Susa. Now, he's giving you a little bit of historical backdrop here. He's letting you know, okay, this is when this took place. This is where this took place. Now, it's important for you to know that this is a historical event, both in the Persian, empire, and then also inside the nation of the history of Israel. And so historically, we know that Artaxerxes ruled over Persia, or the Persian Empire, from 485 to 465 BC. So what he's trying to do is he's giving you a little bit of context. Okay, historically, this is where this took place. It's also important that he gives you the location. I'll let you know why later. But inside the Persian Empire, the emperor would move from fortress to fortress. And so he's saying, okay, this is when I received this news, when this story took place, we were at the fortress of Susa. I'll tell you why that's important as we move forward in the story. But he's saying, okay, this is where I was. This is historically where this took place. He says, I was at the fortress of Susa. Hanani, one of my brothers, came to visit me with some other men who had just arrived from Judah. I asked them about the Jews who had returned there from captivity and about how things were going in Jerusalem. Now, again, historical context, you need to know, Israel has basically been destroyed. And multiple kingdoms have taken people in different directions. And so the nation of Israel is spread out in exile. They find themselves in captivity in all sorts of different places. Nehemiah finds himself in a very lucky place because rather than being killed or rather than being a slave in someone's household through the countryside, he actually finds himself serving in the king's court. All right, he's actually serving the emperor. And so he finds himself in a fortunate position, but his whole family and his whole nation has been scattered. But a few of them have begun to return to Jerusalem. And so there's this hope that, okay, things are going to begin to be restored. And so as this news comes from Judea, he asks them, okay, what's happening? I know that some of the captives have been able to return. Is the restoration process beginning? He says, they said to me, things are not going well for those who return to the province of Judah. They are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem has been torn down and the gates have been destroyed by fire. When I heard this, I sat down and wept. In fact, for days, I mourned. Nehemiah is living in exile. His people, his nation, his family's been scattered. And for the nation of Israel, this wasn't just about a nationality thing. This wasn't just about rebuilding a city. This had to do with what they believed God had called them to be. Because God had challenged them that, listen, you're going to take me to the world around you. And the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the temple wasn't just about a nationality. It was about people knowing who God was and the beauty and the glory of who God was. And so as Nehemiah hears this, he has all this hope because all of a sudden some of the captives are going back home. And so he has this hope that's built up that, listen, maybe it's beginning to be restored. Maybe Jerusalem is beginning to be rebuilt. Maybe the temple can be rebuilt. But as the news comes, I said, no, it's actually in complete ruin. The gates have been burnt down. It's not being rebuilt. It's actually crumbling. The walls have fallen. He was so hopeful for the beginning of restoration, but then he finds out, and I think that they intentionally use this word, that it's a disgrace. And he looks at the situation, and it's one of those moments where he looks at the story, and he's like, this isn't the way it's supposed to be. This isn't the way it's supposed to be. And he begins to mourn. He's overwhelmed by it. And I think a lot of us know what it's like to find ourselves in those situations and in that moment. You're just overwhelmed by it. Like, I don't even know what to do with this. But then as the story continues, rather than Nehemiah just being overwhelmed by it, he begins to respond to it. And he does so in a way that I think is very unique. And as he does so, I think it informs, okay, how do we respond to this? Because even though he's overwhelmed by it, he doesn't come to the point of despair. Even though he's mourning it, he doesn't actually lose hope. Listen to how it continues. It says, when I heard this, I sat down and wept. In fact, for days I mourned, fasted, and prayed to the God of heaven. Then I said, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps his covenant of unfailing love with those who love him and obey his commands, listen to my prayer. Look down and see me praying night and day for your people Israel. I confess that we have sinned against you. Yes, even my own family and I have sinned. We have sinned terribly by not obeying the commands and decrees and regulations that you gave us through your servant Moses. Please remember what you told your servant Moses. If you are unfaithful to me, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and obey my commands and live by them, then even if you are exiled to the ends of the earth, I will bring you back to the place I have chosen for my name to be honored. The people you rescued by your great power and strong hand are your servants. O Lord, please hear my prayer. Listen to the prayers of those who delight in honoring you. Please grant me success today by making the king favorable to me. Put it in his heart to be kind to me. In those days, I was the king's cupbearer. He finds himself in this moment, and he's confronted with this news, and he's looking, and he's like, this isn't the way that it's supposed to be. But rather than it being something that moves him away from God, it's actually something that moves him towards God. And I think as you hear him pray, in the midst of this prayer, I think you hear two things, and two foundational things that Nehemiah believes about the world around him and about who God is, that factors into this moment moving him towards God as opposed to away from God. Because as he begins to enter into this conversation with God about what's happening, the first thing that you notice is that he doesn't come to God and say, God, listen, you're responsible for this. How could you possibly have allowed this to happen? But instead, as he comes to God, he says, God, the truth is, we're responsible for this. And when he looks at the situation, he doesn't say, God, how could you have let this happen? He actually looks at the situation and says, God, the truth is you told us this was going to happen. You told us if we walked away from you, you told us if we didn't acknowledge you, if we didn't listen to your instruction and guidance, that this is exactly what was going to happen. And he begins not to put the responsibility on God, but he begins to take the responsibility. And he says, listen, I understand that when sin enters into the world, when we began to walk away from you, that this is the reality of what the world was going to look like. And one of the things that God is trying to help us understand over and over and over again throughout the scriptures is that, listen, sin destroys the world around us. Big or small, it doesn't matter what it is. It destroys the world around us. And as you see Nehemiah enter into this conversation, you see that he understands that. And so when he looks at this moment, he says, this isn't the way it's supposed to be. He doesn't say, God, how could you let this happen? He looks at it and says, God, look at what we've done. Look at what we've done. And even though he wasn't one of the ones who caused this to happen, he actually takes personal responsibility for this. He says, as a matter of fact, me and my family, the truth is we don't deserve for you to rescue us from this because we're part of the problem in this. Just this realization that, listen, no, I understand that we've created this mess. I understand that it's as we've walked away from you and as we've cared very little for how you've instructed us and guided us. I understand that we've created this. I think you see first this idea of responsibility, but then in addition to that, not only do you see that he takes responsibility, but then in addition, you also see that there's something unique that he believes about who God is. Because he doesn't just say, listen, you promised that this would happen if we walked away from you. But then as he continues in the conversation, he says, but you also promised that you would restore. He says, but you also promised, God, that you would restore. And I know that you are a God who restores. He says, you said even if we were exiled to the ends of the earth, that you would restore. He says, I know that you're a God who restores. And I want to tell you something today, no matter where you are in this journey, no matter what you're confronting, I want you to know something. God has made a promise to you as well, and that is this, that there will be a day when He will restore. And Nehemiah, even though he's overwhelmed by the moment, he's not brought to despair in the moment because he has this unbelievable hope that the God of the universe, the God of Abraham and Isaac, the God of his people, the God who we know, sent Jesus Christ to give his life for us. That he is not a God who is disengaged and who has left us, but that he is a God who loves to restore, a God who is full of mercy and grace, who loves to step into situations that we have broken to bring beauty. And so in this moment, rather than moving away from God, he's drawn towards God. And he comes to God and says, God, listen, I know that this is who you are. And so here's the deal. Here's the deal. If you would, please just allow the king to show me favor. Which is an amazing thing, because basically by the time he gets to the end of the passage, not only has he accepted responsibility for the way that things look and understanding that, listen, you know what, we've made this mess, but then as he comes to the end of it, he doesn't just come and say, God, listen, you need to do something about this. He actually, as he comes to the end of the conversation, he says, so here's the deal, God, if you would, and he's not trying to manipulate God. I love how he prays this, because he's not saying, God, you have to, but he's saying, God, if you would, use me to do something about it. And then I love the last line of this chapter. It's so cool because you see the problem and it's kind of the historical context of the problem. You see this long prayer and this conversation that he has with God. And then the last line, it's just like this little tag on line. At the end of the chapter, it says, in those days, I was the king's cupbearer, which is basically Nehemiah just letting us know I had no business being used. Do you know what a cupbearer is? You know what they do? They drink for a living. For some of you, that's like a dream job. You're like, wow, are you serious? It's like when you hear of those Anheuser-Busch guys that just taste the different batches, right? I mean, I have friends who spent years trying to become that person. It's very hard to become that person. You're like, wow, but he just throws it in, this little tagline at the end of it. Like, in those days, I was a cupbearer. Now, I don't know about you, but if I'm looking to rebuild a city, I'm not enlisting a cupbearer. Okay, maybe an engineer, maybe somebody who has some fighting experience. You hear that he's in the king's palace, right? That he's a part of the king's entourage, and you're thinking to yourself, okay, God's going to use like an army captain to be able to do this, someone who can fight, someone who knows what they're doing. He's like, oh yeah, I was a cupbearer. Basically, what I did every day was just lift gold cups and drink out of them. That's it. It's like the hardest thing he had to do all day. He's never had a callus in his life. But you look at the situation. And for Nehemiah, the question of what God could do with him had nothing to do with his career. It had nothing to do with his education or his skill set, had nothing to do with his experience. And I think that's why he spends one line to tell us about it. And he spends half the chapter to talk about who God is. Because for Nehemiah, his confidence wasn't found in anything that had to do with him. The potential wasn't found in anything that had to do with him. It had everything to do with who he believed God was and what God wanted to do. He says, oh yeah, I was a cupbearer. This is one of the reasons why I think it's so important that he tells us where he was. because he had no business being a part of the solution. The fortress at Susa is over 800 miles from Jerusalem. Not only is he completely disqualified, but he is a world away. 800 miles is a long ways today. Back then, it was an entirely different world. But he didn't look at his location. He didn't look at his experience. He didn't look at his qualifications. For him, there's one question. Does God want to do this or not? Because if he does, God, if you're willing to, I know you can use me. And I want you to know I'm here to be used. So if you would, let the king look favorably on me. Nehemiah is confronted with that moment where you look at the story and you say, this isn't the way it's supposed to be. And as he asks the question, what if? What if? Even though I'm just a cupbearer, what if I was meant for more? What if? What if? Just maybe God might be able to use me to do something about this. He dared to ask the question, what if? And I know sometimes as we walk through this, it can be difficult to connect with these stories because it's literally thousands of miles away, and we're talking about fortresses, and we're talking about cupbearers, and these aren't things that we've experienced. And so sometimes it's really easy to disengage ourselves from the story because it was so long ago. And so as we move through this series, I not only want you to see individuals through the scriptures who are asking this question, what if, but then also I want to expose you to those who are sitting right next to you who are asking this question, what if? A couple months ago, I had the opportunity to begin to get to know a member of our family who, in a lot of really cool ways, was asking this question, what if? I want to give you a chance to be able to hear his story. So if you would you guys please welcome John Paul to the stage? I contacted John Paul this morning and I said, listen, I'm going to wear my vest and my blue shirt, so you wear your vest and your blue shirt and we can look like twins. I just have to do this. And we have two different size stools that we use. One's really tall, one's short, and I was going to get him the short one just so I could look down on him for the first time in my life. So John Paul, give us a little bit of an introduction into who you are, how you got to where you are as a teacher in Union City.
I'd say I was born and raised in Union City. Lived there up to the age of 16, and then things got kind of rough in the neighborhood. So my parents wanted us to move. We moved to Patterson. It didn't get much better over there. let's be honest. And then from there, God blessed me to play basketball. Started playing. End of high school, I got to play at a small college, Montclair State University. And then from there, I was blessed and got to play in the NBA with the LA Clippers organization. But it was during summer league of that time, at the end of summer league when it was time to sign the contracts, where I just felt in my heart that I couldn't be a professional basketball player as a career. And I remember sitting on Venice Beach and calling up my agent and telling him that, you know, I can't do this. I really love working with youth. I love working with young people, and I want to do that. And he's like, oh, that's great. You know, we'll set up a foundation, and there'll be great people that'll take care of that for you. And I said, no, the biggest thing that impacted my life wasn't just watching, you know, highlights on YouTube of a player or buying their jersey at Sports Authority. It was people who were actually there in my life every single day. And so I want to be that. And so I came back to Union City and had the privilege of you know, getting to work with youth, and I figured where are they most? 8 hours a day they're in school, so why not become a public school teacher?
That's awesome. And yeah. And then as you step into teaching, something happens in Union City which kind of prompts you to begin what will eventually be called Flight Club.
You know, I love Union City. You know, it's awesome being there. But as a teacher, when I came back, they had done something where they combined two high schools into one high school. And if you ever drive by Kennedy Boulevard over on 25th Street, you'll see this beautiful building on the right-hand side. I mean, they even have the football field on the roof of the building, three stories up. It's awesome. But when you combine two high schools into one, you take two football teams, and now you only have one, which means you have 70 kids that used to be on a team that now have nothing to do. You take two basketball teams, combine them to one, that's 30 kids. You go down the line, you have a couple hundred kids with nothing to do that once felt purpose, that once felt a sense of family and belonging. And I started to see that, and then I also saw the gang enrollment increase as well, because they just wanted that family. They wanted that sense that someone wanted them. And so what I did just to, you know, try to stem the problem was figuring all these kids are getting cut. They want to be faster. They want to be stronger. They want to be bigger. So I started putting flyers up around school. You know, do you want to run faster? Do you want to get stronger? Do you want to jump higher? And 80-something kids show up the first day in my classroom after school saying, what's this about? And I said, all right, we'll just do push-ups. And we did push-ups and didn't fit in the classroom anymore, so went down the hallway and then bought sandbags from Home Depot for $3, and they started running up and down the stairs with sandbags on their, you know, on their shoulders. And then girls wanted to join it, and so we allowed the girls to be a part of it and started kickboxing for girls to learn self-defense but then also self-esteem. And it just started becoming bigger and bigger and just blossoming into something really beautiful that God was doing.
And it started just in a classroom, right? You're just using what you had in the classroom, and then it kind of expanded out.
Yeah,
it
was amazing how it went to start in the classroom and then in the hallway. And then before you know it, we had a great superintendent, and he saw the program and its potential and what was happening to the kids as they were gaining this confidence and staying off the streets. And so he asked us to be in all the middle schools and the high schools in Union City. And so we were able to start those programs, satellite programs, all throughout the district, which is really great to see.
And then now you're kind of taking the next step and asking this question, what if, and dreaming. So what are you working towards now?
Well, you know, just like you said, you know, when God puts something in your heart, you know, you feel you gotta go forward with it. And so I've kind of put my job to the side a little bit.
He quit his job, that's what he's saying.
That's, yeah. And pursuing this full time. And so we found a location in the middle of the city. And one of the interesting things about Union City is it's 70,000 people in about one square mile. Basically, it's the most populated city per square mile in the whole entire United States. But there's never been a YMCA and there's never been a Boys and Girls Club. And instead of, you know, asking, hey, why isn't there one? We said, why don't we make one? You know, why don't we make a place not just where kids can go to hang out, but where there can be a dedication to excellence, not just physically, but also through character development and through academics. And that's what our goal is this year, as soon as possible, is to build this center and to give them a place where they can go. And we're going to call the center the Hope and Future Center, because we truly believe that when you have a hope, then you truly can see the future God has for you.
And so, yeah, isn't that... As I said, I met John Paul a couple months ago as he's... became part of our family and started getting connected here and hearing the story of what God was doing. And for those of you who've been with us throughout the year, you know that one of our major focuses this year is mobilize and looking at, okay, how can God use us in greater ways throughout our city and our surrounding communities? And so we came alongside of John Paul, and it was about a month ago that we formalized our partnership. And so Hoboken Grace is now a financial partner in Hope and Future and getting this thing launched. I know sometimes you guys wonder, well, you know, when I give, where does it go? This is one of those things that we're able to come alongside of and to be able to give to, which we're really, really excited about and really excited about the potential of this. But then I also know that for some of you, not only are you giving here, but then in addition, for some of you, you kind of look for opportunities like this to be able to give above and beyond and to be able to make something like this become a reality. And so I wanted to bring this to your attention. Currently, The Hope and Future Center has raised about 30,000 of the necessary 50 to be able to get going and to make sure that this is able to be provided throughout that first year. And so for some of you, if they're interested in coming alongside of you in that way, what's the website? How can, and they can give on the website, right? And to be able to make that. And it's a 501c3 fully charitable organization.
Yeah, it's www.hope-future.us. That's the website where you can go. You can find out more information. We had one of the artists in the area wanted to do a documentary about it because he was so inspired. You can watch a short video in the About section. And even besides that, I mean, you know, if anyone even feels God has given them talent and physical abilities and always want to use it, you know, we got 7th and 8th graders trying to learn how to do, you know, kettlebell swings, but we don't have kettlebells. We use cinder blocks. They're cheaper. But they're getting a workout, and they're feeling good about themselves. Is that something that you feel inspired to do? You know, you're great at CrossFit, and you always want to be able to train, you know, maybe someone in a freshman in high school alongside. We're definitely open to that, too. And it's just a blessing to be able to be a part of it.
Yeah. And after the service, John Paul will be out front here so you can connect with him and ask questions. But it may be one of those opportunities. Maybe as you're sitting here, God's put on your heart to be able to come alongside of the Hope and Future Center and to help this become a reality. We're really excited to be working together in this, and it's one of those ways that I think God's going to be able to really open a lot of doors for us to be able to partner both financially, but then also for us to be able to get involved in kids' lives in a really, really unique way. So would you guys just celebrate John Paul and what's happening there one more time? What if? I think almost all of us at some point are confronted with the reality that it's not the way it's supposed to be. I remember walking out of that Jubilee Center and looking at it, it's not the way it's supposed to be. But the question is, what are you going to do with it? You know, the day I walked out of that Jubilee Center, we decided we're going to do something about this. It drove us for over a year and a half before we were finally able to begin the process of launching True Mentors. Because I sat at the table, I said, it's not supposed to be like this. It's just a teacher. He's got a classroom. He's looking at what's happening in these kids' lives. It's not supposed to be like this. Nehemiah looked at the moment. It's not supposed to be like this. But in the midst of the moment, he didn't just get upset. And I think for some of us, we see it and we get upset. But the problem is, I think sometimes we think it's sufficient enough to just simply be upset. What if Nehemiah dared to ask the question, what if? What if the reason that you're so passionate about the problem is because the truth is God created you to be part of the restoration? What if God really does want to restore? What if he really is a God of grace and mercy? What if? And the truth is, Nehemiah had no idea, but he dared to ask the question, what if? God, if you would use me, then I just ask that you would allow the king to show me favor. I just want you to know I'm here. What if you were meant for more? I want to challenge you with two questions as we go out of this week, as we begin this conversation. The first one is this: what is the problem that God's placed on your heart? What is that thing that you just can't get away from? What is that thing that just that breaks you? And maybe you've pushed it down for long enough that you no longer really live with it. But just to move through this week and see if there isn't something that God has for you, that something that God is drawing your attention toward. What is the problem? And the second question that I want you to ask is this: is God actually big enough to do something about it? Do you believe Him that He actually wants to do something about it? And then just to begin to engage Him in this question: what if? And I know for some of you, you're thinking to yourself, well, who am I? Who am I? Nehemiah had every chance to be able to say, who am I? But he knew who he was had nothing to do with it. It really had everything to do with one thing. What if God? What if God is just looking for someone to be used? What if God's ready to do it right now? What if He could use me? What if? Will you pray with me? Father, we live in a world that as we look around, sometimes we can be so overwhelmed by the pain of it and the overwhelming nature of the brokenness. But Father, You've told us that You're a God who abounds in grace and mercy. A God defined by love. You've demonstrated that to us over and over and over again. You've demonstrated it to us personally. You've demonstrated it to us as a family. You've demonstrated it to our city, to our communities. And so, Father, I come to You today. We come to You today. Not to manipulate You, but to beg You. God, demonstrate Your mercy and Your love. Demonstrate Your power and Your glory. And Father, we know that You don't need us. But we also know You love to work through people, and we know that the greatest opportunity available to us is that we might in some way, shape, or form be part of this with You. And so, Father, we just ask that You would show us favor. That You would open our eyes to those places around us where You would have us be part of Your restoration. Father, I pray that we would put aside our limitations that we're using to limit You. And we would begin to dream. We would begin to dream of what's possible. That we would not see the problem as an obstacle, but rather as an opportunity. We would not just get upset. But that we would come before You. And over again, we just want to say, Dad, we just want to say, we're here. Use us. Use us. In whatever way we could be used, use us. In Jesus' name. Amen.